My experience with ALS. A talk given to the British Motor Neurone Disease Association conference in Birmingham in October 1987. I'm quite often asked, how do you feel about having ALS? The answer is not a lot. I try to lead as normal a life as possible and not think about my condition or regret the things it prevents me from doing, which are not that many. It was a very great shock to me to discover that I had motor neurone disease. I'd never been very well coordinated physically as a child. I was not good at ball games, and maybe for this reason I didn't care much for sport or physical activities. But things seemed to change when I went to Oxford. I took up coxing and rowing. I was not boat race standard, but I got by at the level of intercollege competition. In my third year at Oxford, however, I noticed that I seemed to be getting clumsier, and I fell over once or twice for no apparent reason. But it was not until I was at Cambridge in the following year that my mother noticed and took me to the family doctor. He referred me to a specialist, and shortly after my 21st birthday, I went into hospital for tests. I was in for 2 weeks, during which I had a wide variety of tests. They took a muscle sample from my arm, stuck electrodes into me, injected some radio-opaque fluid into my spine, and watched it going up and down with x-rays as they tilted the bed. After all that, they didn't tell me what I had, except that it was not multiple sclerosis, and that I was an atypical case. I gathered, however, that they expected it to continue to get worse, and that there was nothing they could do except give me vitamins. I could see that they didn't expect them to have much effect. I didn't feel like asking for more details, because they were obviously bad. The realization that I had an incurable disease that was likely to kill me in a few years was a bit of a shock. How could something like that happen to me? Why should I be cut off like this? However, while I was in hospital, I'd seen a boy I vaguely knew die of leukemia in the bed opposite me. It had not been a pretty sight. Clearly there were people who were worse off than me. At least my condition didn't make me feel sick. Whenever I feel inclined to be sorry for myself, I remember that boy. Not knowing what was going to happen to me or how rapidly the disease would progress, I was at a loose end. The doctors told me to go back to Cambridge and carry on with the research I had just started in general relativity and cosmology. But I was not making much progress because I didn't have much mathematical background, and anyway I might not live long enough to finish my PhD. I felt somewhat of a tragic character. I took to listening to Wagner, but reports in magazine articles that I drank heavily are exaggeration. The trouble is, once one article said it, then other articles copied it because it made a good story. Anything that has appeared in print so many times must be true. My dreams at that time were rather disturbed. Before my condition was diagnosed, I'd been very bored with life. There had not seemed to be anything worth doing. But shortly after I came out of hospital, I dreamt that I was going to be executed. I suddenly realized that there were a lot of worthwhile things I could do if I were reprieved. Another dream that I had several times was that I would sacrifice my life to save others. After all, if I was going to die anyway, it might as well do some good. But I didn't die. In fact, although there was a cloud hanging over my future, I found to my surprise that I was enjoying life in the present more than I had before. I began to make progress with my research. I got engaged and married, and I got a research fellowship at Caius College, Cambridge. The fellowship at Caius took care of my immediate employment problem. I was lucky to have chosen to work in theoretical physics, because that was one of the few areas in which my condition would not be a serious handicap. And I was fortunate that my scientific reputation increased at the same time that my disability got worse. This meant that people were prepared to offer me a sequence of positions in which I only had to do research without having to lecture. We were also fortunate in housing. When we were married, Jane was still an undergraduate at Westfield College in London, so she had to go up to London during the week. This meant that we had to find somewhere I could manage on my own and that was centrally located, because I could not walk far. I asked the college if they could help, but was told by the then bursar, it is college policy not to help fellows with housing. We therefore put our name down to rent one of a group of new flats that were being built in the marketplace. Years later, I discovered that those flats were actually owned by the college, but they didn't tell me that. When we returned to Cambridge from the summer in America, however, we found that the flats were not ready. As a great concession, the bursar offered us a room in a hostel for graduate students. He said, "We normally charge 12 shillings and 6 pence a night for this room. However, as there will be 2 of you in the room, we'll charge 25 shillings. We stayed there only 3 nights. Then we found a small house about 100 yards from my university department. It belonged to another college, which had let it to one of its fellows. He'd recently moved out to a house in the suburbs, and he sublet the house to us for the remaining 3 months on his lease. During those 3 months, we found another house in the same road standing empty. A neighbour summoned the owner from Dorset and told her it was a scandal that her house should be vacant when young people were looking for accommodation. So she let the house to us. After we'd lived there for a few years, we wanted to buy it and do it up, so we asked my college for a mortgage. The college did a survey and decided it was not a good risk. So in the end, we got a mortgage from a building society, and my parents gave us the money to do it up. We lived there for another 4 years, until it became too difficult for me to manage the stairs. By this time, the college appreciated me rather more, and there was a different bursar. They therefore offered us a ground floor flat in a house that they owned. This suited me very well, because it had large rooms and wide doors. It was sufficiently central that I could get to my university department or the college in my electric wheelchair. It was also nice for our 3 children, because it was surrounded by a garden that was looked after by the college gardeners. Up to 1974, I was able to feed myself and get in and out of bed. Jane managed to help me and bring up 2 children without outside help. Thereafter, however, things became more difficult, so we took to having one of my research students living with us. In return for free accommodation and a lot of my attention, they helped me get up and go to bed. In 1980, we changed to a system of community and private nurses, who came in for an hour or two in the morning and evening. This lasted until I caught pneumonia in 1985. I had to have a tracheostomy operation, and from then on I needed 24-hour nursing care. This was made possible by grants from several foundations. Before the operation, my speech had been getting more slurred, so that only people who knew me well could understand me, but at least I could communicate. I wrote scientific papers by dictating to a secretary, and I gave seminars through an interpreter who repeated my words more clearly. However, the tracheostomy removed my ability to speak altogether. For a time, the only way I could communicate was to spell out words letter by letter by raising my eyebrows when someone pointed to the right letter on a spelling card. It's pretty difficult to carry on a conversation like that, let alone write a scientific paper. However, a computer expert in California named Walt Voltosh heard of my plight. He sent me a computer program he had written called Equalizer. This allowed me to select words from a series of menus on the screen by pressing a switch in my hand. The program could also be controlled by head or eye movement. When I have built up what I want to say, I can send it to a speech synthesizer. At first, I just ran the Equalizer program on a desktop computer. Then David Mason of Cambridge Adaptive Communications fitted a small personal computer and a speech synthesizer to my wheelchair. This system allows me to communicate much better than I could before. I can manage up to 15 words a minute. I can either speak what I've written or save it on disk. I can then print it out or call it back and speak it sentence by sentence. Using this system, I've written 2 books and a number of scientific papers. I've also given a number of scientific and popular talks. They've been well received. I think that is in a large part due to the quality of the speech synthesizer, which is made by Speech Plus. One's voice is very important. If you have a slurred voice, people are likely to treat you as mentally deficient. This synthesizer is by far the best I've heard, because it varies the intonation and doesn't speak like a Dalek. The only trouble is that it gives me an American accent. However, by now, I identify with its voice. I would not want to change, even if I were offered a British-sounding voice. I would feel I'd become a different person. I've had motor neurone disease for practically all my adult life. Yet it has not prevented me from having a very attractive family and being successful in my work. This is thanks to the help I've received from my wife, my children, and a large number of other people and organizations. I've been lucky that my condition has progressed more slowly than is often the case. It shows that one need not lose hope.